Maybe Henry David Thoreau was the most famous example, but he was not the first writer to think getting off by oneself in the woods is a good spur to good writing. Our guest this hour also values solitude in nature. Karen Ovenen loves the quiet of the mountains of Colorado, where she lives. Well, just about anywhere, really, but she lives in Colorado. And she lived in a remote, quiet setting several years ago when her cabin burned down. She and her dog were fine, not so for her possessions, including most of her writing. That's part of the story Karen tells in her memoir, Rough Beauty, 40 Seasons of Mountain Living. Karen Ovenen is a writer of both prose and poetry, for which she has won awards. You can find some of her other work in literary journals and the New York Times. This is Karen's first book, out last year and now reintroduced in a paperback edition. Karen, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thanks, Jeffrey, for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
Good to have you. So your place in the mountains was really your first home all to yourself, this cabin that burned?
Yes, it was, and I was nearly 40 years old. I happened to, I lived a very transient life, and I kept going back to school. I got a bachelor's degree, and I worked for a little while, and I got a master's, and I worked for a little while. And so I was kind of, I never quite settled down, and also I live in, I live in or around Boulder County in Boulder, Colorado, and it's quite expensive. So I couldn't afford a home of my own, and so I usually always had to have roommates. And so I got my PhD, and I came back to Colorado, and I found this little mountain cabin, and I could finally afford it, and I staked my claim on an acre of land and set out to be a writer, and I was a writer, but, you know, really sink into the writing life, and 9 months later, the cabin burned to the ground.
Oh, wow, so just 9 months in that place. I didn't realize it was that short.
Yes. The book... That's the beginning of the book. I talk about losing everything, and then the process of the book is the 10 years or 40 seasons I lived in another cabin, and that was all my own. But that was, these were the first my first experiences of living by myself without the distraction or nuisance of roommates, and it was, you know, it's fantastic.
How big or small was the place? I mean, how cozy was it with you and Elvis the dog?
I would say fairly cozy. The cabin that burned down was about 650 square feet. The cabin that I moved into after, which was even more rustic, if you can imagine, it was made of wood 2x4s, and there were little cracks where the wood, essentially wood bricks, where the bricks would come together, and the air could get through, and light could get through, and snow in the wintertime could get through. That one was about 500 square feet.
Wow. Had you lived that close to nature before?
I had lived in and around the little mountain town of Jamestown, which is outside of Boulder, for, I'd say maybe nearly a decade. But, mountain town living is a little bit different than where I was living remotely, which is about 4 miles up the mountain and 1,500 feet higher, so 8,500 feet up there.
Well, it sounds like you were very much in rhythm with the seasons, although it's not always like you had a choice, particularly in winter.
Well, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why I like to live wild, as I call it, is because you do need to live with the rhythm of the seasons, and it forces a kind of surrender on you. I don't wear sleeveless shirts in December. When there's a snowstorm out, I have to stay put. And I think that's a really important lesson for humans. I think too often we think of ourselves as much bigger of a presence than we are. And I think that it's good to be reminded that there are forces, particularly natural forces, that are bigger than us. Starting with weather is a great way to start. Yesterday I was listening to your weather report. We don't have summer yet. It's 48 degrees today. And we had a huge hailstorm yesterday, and the temperature dropped 20 degrees, and we're dashing to, we had just brought our plants outside, and we were trying to save them and bring them back in. So I think it's a good experience to watch what's happening outside.
Truly. Didn't it snow in Denver like 2 weeks ago?
You know, it snowed at the end of May.
Uh-huh.
So we really have not had summer yet by any stretch of the imagination. And where I live, which is significantly higher, about 3,000 feet, it's been chilly.
Indeed. I want to talk about your companion just a little bit. We just touched on Elvis. Tell us about this big dog and how you came to know him.
Well, I had always wanted a dog of my own. I was actually driven by, I have a very independent existence. I was very much a loner, and I wanted to go out and go camping and backpacking and do things, and I didn't want to necessarily wait for my friends who were busy with their boyfriends or whatever on the weekend. And I wanted to go and do these things myself, but I also wanted a companion. So I got a dog in my 30s. And this dog, you know, it was kind of, they say that you don't pick the dog picks you. And I think that's really true. I had been to the pound a couple times. And the third time I went, this dog showed up. I had just, I had been living in a mountain house, and I got kicked out because of a bad roommate situation. 3 weeks later, in my new mountain house, I got Elvis. So I feel like we were fated to be. And he was a 72-pound husky mix, blonde, beautiful, and wild, really feral. Huskies like to run. They're very independent. They're very smart. They want to go do what they want to do. And so initially our battle was trying to get him to come back when I called. And in order to get him to do that, I trained him by putting a leash around my waist and attaching it to him. And so when I got up in the morning, you know, I'm having coffee. When I walked across the room, he had to walk with me. When I sat down, he had to sit down. And I tried to instill in him the sense that we belong together so that, you know, when he ran off, he knew to come back to me. And that actually ended up working. I took him to dog obedience classes, but they were largely a bust because he couldn't believe we were going to be in a room full of dogs and not play with them. But I did manage to get him to, I could never say Elvis come, but I could get him, I could say Elvis wait, and he would stop and wait for me. And because when we first started hiking together, you know, I would take the dog off the leash because huskies need to run. And in a matter of seconds, he was gone. He had disappeared. I had no idea where he was. So getting him to circle back to me was really super important. And I really learned how to do that with this leash technique. And what's interesting is over the course of the book, I really realized that that leash becomes a metaphor for the connection between us. And I tried to tether him to me to keep him safe. But he also tethered me to him, and that was all about learning how to love someone.
It was a great relationship. I love the descriptions of Elvis romping in the snow. It sounds like nothing's happier than a 72-pound husky in a snowstorm.
It's an amazing thing to see.
We're talking to Karen Ovenen, who lives in the mountains in Colorado still and had gotten to have her first real place by herself in a mountain cabin a number of years ago. It was just she and her 72-pound blonde husky, Elvis, and was really enjoying the solitude and the rhythm of the seasons in the mountains of Colorado, and then her cabin burned down. And that is the first major event we see in her book, Rough Beauty, 40 Seasons of Mountain Living. You can join our conversation on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So you and Elvis were returning from a trip out when you saw warm glow in the woods on the 1st of March 1 year.
Right. And I thought, you know, as we drove toward it, it's a beautiful kind of like the light that a campfire casts in the woods. And I thought, oh, and then I got closer to the house and I could see these kind of orange and scarlet ripples. And I thought, it looked like a fumigator's tent. And I thought, what? My landlord is fumigating? And then all of a sudden I realized that my house is on fire. And so I stomped on the gas pedal and I drove up to the house, and the west portion of the house was on fire, and the deck and my house was kind of a long house, and so one side of it basically was on fire, and the fire was moving like a train through a station in my house, and so my neighbors came out. They had called the fire department. I live rurally, so it's a VFD. That day, nobody was on the mountain. Subsequently, things have changed with the volunteer fire department, but at the time, there was nobody up there. So I think we waited for over an hour before a truck got there. And then it got stuck because it had started to snow, and it slid down my driveway and into a gully. I did various things. I ran up to the house. I ran back. I parked my car across the street. I left Elvis. I ran back up to the house. And I tried to get, the only thing I was thinking about was my computer, which had everything. And at the time, I didn't have a laptop. This was in 2004. I had a desktop, and I thought, I just need to get my hard drive out of there. And that was on the other side of the house away from the fire. And I opened the door, and it just let all this air in to the fire and caused it to just really blow up, and black smoke came pouring out and literally pushed me off the deck and onto the ground. And so I think I say in the book, I broke three rules of fire. You know, don't run toward the fire, don't add air to the flame. I did all kinds of stuff. So I had to just basically retreat and watch as my house burned and wait for the fire department.
What was you had things you had bought for the place, and you described some of your other possessions, but that train and the station effect you just talked about was really like watching the fire get closer and closer to your computer with all your writing. Was that really the only place you had your stuff stored?
It was really the only place. You know, everybody, all my writer friends, like, whisper about Karen's fire. And, you know, they talk about Hemingway and his lost stories. And it was really the only place. One colleague used me as a cautionary tale to his creative writing class, and he carried a little external drive everywhere. It was really the only place.
So. You did have some hard copies, and in fact, you write in the book of your poems haunting the mountain after the fire. What happened?
Well, what's interesting, so my house, the 650 square feet or whatever, was reduced to about 3 feet or 4 feet, 3 feet of ash, I would say, and we dug through it, and I found just a few things. I mean, my KitchenAid mixer melted. My professional knives were gone, but I found a bear fetish that I have that is made of pumice, right, so fire-resistant. And so I found a few little relics, but my journals, so there's all this paper from my journals, years, decades of journals, and it burnt bits of paper. And after the fire, it took them about 4 months to clean up the site, they weren't salvageable, but these little bits of paper kind of fluttered around the landscape when it continued to snow and blow. And I actually had a neighbor who said, you know, sidled up to me in the Jamestown Merc, which is the Mountain Town Cafe where I worked. And she said, you know, I've been collecting your bits of writing, and I was going to make a poem or a story for you. And it made me so angry. I know she was trying to be nice, but I was so angry. I thought, those are my words. Please don't touch that. You know, so I write in the book, my writing haunts the landscape.
That's kind of like having somebody touch your psyche if they've got your writing in their hands, isn't it?
Right. And it's also, you know, it's my journal. So, you know, it's pretty much the raw material stuff. Yeah, it felt a little invasive, I got to say.
Karen Ovenen is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her memoir is called Rough Beauty, 40 Seasons of Mountain Living. And in the book, you take us back in time to your childhood. Can you count up all the places you've lived?
I always get lost. We moved, you know, we're really, in terms of military families, we were luckier than most. But I think we moved about every 5 years. So, but it just always seemed like the key time in my life. We moved a couple of times before I was five, and then I was in. I went to one place in kindergarten through about. I think we were in. I was in third grade when we moved again, in middle of the year. And actually, we got an excuse for the rest of the semester because we moved in April, so we didn't have to start a new school. So, you know, and that happened a couple of times where I was the new kid, but I didn't know any kids because we weren't in school. And so we really only lived in a couple places in California. I was born in Nevada. We moved to Colorado. Then we moved to Hawaii, which was a shock. that was our quote-unquote overseas tour. And then my parents' marriage broke up, so then I moved back to Colorado with my mother. And then I moved to Boulder. But then after I went to college, I kind of relive this itinerant lifestyle by having so many addresses as a renter in Boulder County, in college, out of college. So I really did have this kind of never feeling like I belonged anywhere. And I think it was enhanced by the fact that my family we're like tumbleweeds. We're not close. There's no kind of sense of extended family. There's no farm where we go to see the grandparents, you know. So I feel like it just, for me, it was the one thing that I wanted, and I was jealous of kids who, you know, knew the same, their friends from kindergarten through high school. I thought, oh, I want to have that kind of rootedness in the world.
Mm-hmm. And you disposed of it in talking about your parents' marriage breaking up, but it was a really bad home to get training in what a good marriage looks like, it sounds like.
Well, yeah, I didn't really, there was no, yeah. No, it was my house was unpredictable. My dad has a bigger, larger-than-life personality that tends toward excess and violence and kind of taking up all the air in the room. And my mom was invisible. I mean, I have this kind of, I don't have memories of her from when I was a kid. She just kind of was way under the radar. And our house was violent, my dad. And I was the rebel, so I was the, you know, kind of on the receiving end of a lot of that violence because I thought, well, I'm going to just say no. I'm just going to be the one who says this is wrong. And there were definitely consequences for that.
So you stood up to him, you're saying?
Yeah, I did. I felt like there were times when I felt like my father was a bit of he was a bully with our family. And he was scary. He was intimidating. And I think people were trying to avoid him and were afraid of him, my siblings, my mother. And so, yeah, I stood up to him.
So I'll spare the descriptions of evenings at home. I mean, you already mentioned violence, and we don't need to go into a lot of detail here. But I wonder if did this drive you to the refuge of books? I mean, without friends and without a really stable family life, is that really what inspired the interest in reading?
Oh, of course. And, you know, and my parents weren't great readers themselves. And if they had been, I always imagine what books I might have been put into my hands. But I started with genre reading. I mean, I read romance novels and fantasy and science fiction. And then when I went to high school, my first love was Truman Capote. I loved his gothic southern novels. And it's great stuff if you're a teenager because it's so black and moody. And I thought, oh, somebody feels like I do. And then I fell in love with Joseph Conrad, and then it was Shakespeare. And so, yes, I think my family life was so unstable that I used to ask to go to the library every single night as soon as dinner was finished so I could just go someplace that was quiet, and I would read and study there.
Karen Ovenen is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, her memoir of life in the Colorado mountains, and coming back from having her cabin burned down with most of her writing in it, is called Rough Beauty, 40 Seasons of Mountain Living. So did life improve, Karen, when your parents finally split?
Yes, it did. it improved. I was thinking of, I had, you know, definitely had post-traumatic stress syndrome. It improved for me in terms of the no immediate threat of physical violence or, you know, a psychological abuse. But, you know, it took me a long time to recover, and part of my recovery, honestly, was living in the mountains. I think one of the things that happened is because I grew up in this family that really didn't, where I didn't learn that it was okay to trust other people, or I didn't understand really what love was like because the people who loved me hurt me the most. I think that was the kind of one of the first, you know, reasons why I decided to walk away. I thought I'm going to leave. I'm going to leave my family. I'm going to leave society. And the other reason is because I think, and I only thought about this in retrospect as I was writing the book, but, you know, in my family, I grew up in the 70s. I was supposed to be, and I graduated in the 80s, I was supposed to be somebody's wife. That was what I was told I was going to be. And I would make a good wife someday, or Miss America. And I'm just, my sensibility isn't to lie flat, which was the conception of what a wife would be, somebody who would just behave and do as she was told. And I'm just not, those things didn't fit me. And I got those same kinds of messages when I was in college, you know, about my abilities as a woman.
Thinking that was around the time in history when people were still joking about MRS degrees for women.
Well, you know, we say that about that time, but I teach college first years now, and I still have women who have been told to go to college and find a good doctor to marry. So we're not out of the woods.
And it turns out you wanted to be that good doctor. You had big plans at the University of Colorado, English major and pre-med?
English major, biology major, and I was a pre-med student.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it is because I got so many messages growing up from my family and from society that my strength didn't matter, that my agency didn't matter, that what I wanted didn't matter, and that I was probably weak anyway, that I thought, I'm going to show them. So I picked the hardest degree I could think of. My family's very much blue collar. My parents didn't go to college. And I thought, I'll be a doctor. And, you know, my dad in response would say, well, how are you going to pay for that? You know, that was hey, that's great. We're so proud of you. So I decided I would be a doctor. And about 3 months before I graduated, I realized, I don't really want to be a medical doctor. What am I thinking? And I took some time off. And, you know, my first love has always been language and literature and reading and writing. And I didn't even take a creative writing class in college when I was doing my bachelor's. I was too intimidated. But that was my secret desire all along. I had been writing and writing and writing and making stories and writing poems. And so finally I screwed up the courage somewhere in my late 20s to take a creative writing class, and then I jumped into a master's degree in literature and quickly switched to creative writing poetry.
Wow. So all at once, I mean, a lot of deferred maintenance or deferred something, but then into it with both feet and arms.
Well, that's a story of my life. I kind of take the circuitous route, and then once I commit, I am there 400%, so...
You describe along about the time you were in college originally, gaining a reputation for toughness. How did that express itself?
Oh, you know, I would arm wrestle with all the guys when I was in high school and in college, and very often I won. I was a little bit of a drinker in college, and I drank whiskey because, you know, that's a tough drink.
Sure.
And so I would drink shots of Jack Daniels, and I think I tell a story in the book where when we were in college, and please, college kids, don't do this, but when we were in college, we had a thing called the Turkey Trot. And it was to see who could drink the most shots of Wild Turkey. It's a really not a smart thing to do.
Yeah, I think some of us remember that too. Yeah. Turkey.
So I drank 16 shots of Wild Turkey. And the reason why I drank 16 shots of Wild Turkey is because at shot 12, I excused myself, went to the bathroom and threw up, and then came back. So I just basically, I made myself so I could keep going. And amazingly, did not get alcohol poisoning, so...
That is amazing and lucky. Rough Beauty, 40 Seasons of Mountain Living is the memoir by Karen Auvin and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Let's talk about your last name. It was an interesting rebellion here, changing that. What led up to that?
You know, what led up to that is in college, I had taken this feminist theology class, and which was basically, we studied goddess religions for the first half of the class, and then in the second half of the class, we made rituals. And it was really fun. And one of the rituals I learned was a ritual of naming myself by my mothers, Karen, daughter of Susan, daughter of Alice, daughter of Mary, daughter of Valborg, which is a woman who lived in Finland/Russia on the border there. And I thought, wow, why can't, you know, I have my mom's name too. And I thought there was great power in choosing a name for myself. And at this point, because my father was so kind of a larger than life and not positive presence in my life, I wanted to, you know, somehow establish myself as separate, really, from him. I wanted to have my own, it was a symbolic act of agency, like, this is who I am. I wanted to declare it to the world. So I took my mother's last name, Auvinen. And I'm proud to say I'm the only Auvinen in the state of Colorado. I don't think there's another one.
So, and the paternal side of your family reacted how?
Oh, not very well at all. I am, you know, my father is Italian. His father's Italian. We're from the northern part of Italy. And my grandfather, bless his heart, just very old world, kind gentleman, but very, you know, very old world, called me. And that in itself was a huge thing, because the grandfather never called you. You called him. That was how it worked. He called me and said, what's the matter? Isn't my name good enough for you? And I tried to explain, and he was furious. And he said, you know, all I'm going to say is if you're Karen Marie Grosso in my will, and if you change that one day, you're going to be very sorry. And, you know, which is a strange thing because, you know, my family doesn't have any money, so I don't know exactly what he was threatening me with. But he never spoke to me again. And he died about a decade later of Alzheimer's disease. And so at the end, he wasn't quite sure, like, why he never heard from me anymore. And then my father said, I love you, I support you, but now you have to call me Wayne, which is his name, and I lost the right to call him father. And I thought, oh, come on, don't give me a mixed message, you know. And so we had an argument about it. And then he kept calling me, and he left increasingly more threatening messages on my machine saying we had to hash this out. And I didn't really want to talk about it anymore. And then he finally threatened to come get me, come see me at my work. And this was my dad, you know, kind of intimidation and bluster. And I was planning to go back to school the following fall. This was kind of in the spring of a year. And I needed to save some money, so I lit out for territory. I moved and pitched a tent in the wilderness and spent the summer in the woods.
Uh-huh. Okay, so that really was a spur to your first stint living wild.
Yeah, it was.
Well, you know, the way you describe your father, I can understand that, and I'm sure any other reader would, too. The book is called Rough Beauty, 40 Seasons of Mountain Living. We have been comparing this hour's guest to Henry David Thoreau in the sense of getting off in the woods and enjoying the solitude and having it spur writing. It certainly works for Karen Auvinen. She's written a memoir about life in the woods called Rough Beauty, 40 Seasons of Mountain Living, and she was really enjoying her first solo place up in the mountains of Colorado when it burned to the ground in the late winter of 2004. Her descriptions of what led up to that and what came out of it is described in the book. You can join the conversation on the exchange if you'd like to, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So back to the fire aftermath. Before you were alone and free, how did you feel after that?
Well, the fire aftermath was quite a shock. I mean, it's a death. You are shorn from everything, and your brain can't kind of figure out what has happened. Because, one of the most pitiful feelings I had, which was after the fire, I spent one night, the Red Cross put me up in a motel room with my dog, and they said, you know, we could give you more money to rebuild if you would stop taking money for a motel room. So I spent a couple of nights with a friend of mine who lived in Jamestown, about 6 miles from my cabin, and I woke up and it had suddenly become winter again. It was March 3rd or something, and I didn't have any warm clothes, and the town had hastily donated clothing items. But I'm not a small woman, and so I couldn't just pick out anything to wear. So I found something that fit, and I put it on, and it smelled like somebody else. And I started to cry like a little baby because there was no sense of comfort. So I'll never forget that feeling, the thing of, you know, my favorite coffee mug or my own bed or even a toothbrush, not having anything at all, it was devastating.
That's interesting you mentioned crying like a baby, because I've heard stories of babies who do cry when they're held by somebody else because they don't recognize the smell.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I'm not a crier, but I cried a lot actually after my house burned down. And, you know, I most famously have a glass of wine or two, and then I would kind of, you know, tears would start to leak out of my eyes about what had happened. I think that was my grieving process.
You were almost 40 years old by this point. How deeply did this set about a review of your life choices so far?
I have just taken the wandering path in my life, and I have come to terms with that. I've never been a rocket. I don't go from point A to point B directly and quickly. And, you know, it's really about these steps that we take in our lives. It's not about where we get. It's about how we got there. And so it was okay. Of course, it was devastating to feel like I had done so much work. I think I compare it to being Sisyphus. You know, I rolled this rock up the hill finally. I had to, you know, fight tooth and nail to get where I was, and then it just all went up into smoke. And I had to start over again, and that was daunting. And it, you know, it set my writing career back about 10 years, I'd say.
So, the loss of all you had written set you back 10 years? You say, did you try to recreate, or did you look at this at some point as a chance to make yourself a new life in words, or did you turn some corner, or try to regain what you'd lost?
No, you learned. I think the most important thing is I learned really the art of surrender. You have to just accept what happens. I say in the book, it's our resistance that kills us. And it's the part of you that says, I don't want this to be happening, or this is not happening, or why did this happen? That part of us is the part that tortures us and makes things difficult. But the minute you say, okay, this is what happened, and what do I do next, is the part that's where recovery comes from. And so I didn't try to recreate anything. It was too much. It was 20 years of writing. And what I did, you know, I'm a poet, and I hear things before I put them on the page. And so a lot of the stuff lines that I had from poems would come back to me, or pieces of stories would come back to me. And then this other thing that happened is that my friends, over the course of 20 years, who had gotten hard copies of my work, began to send some things back to me. So I did get a few things back in the mail, which was lovely. And, of course, I had a dissertation and a master's thesis filed at two different universities. So there's that work there, too.
Did you do any fire poetry? Did you sit down at some point and write up the loss, the rage, all the things you were feeling about the fire?
No, I think I wrote this book instead. I mean, I tried for years to write. At first, I was going to write a book about the fire because I had my dramatic event, and then it was going to be about seasonal mountain living. But it was going to be a collection of essays. And then when I finally sold this book to Scribner, I had to conceive of it as a memoir and really a story about how I got to where I was, what happened, and then how I changed over time. And really it's about how the mountains have, you know, how I've learned to surrender to mountain living, you know, how I found my wholeness in solitude and space, and how really the natural world coaxed me back into myself after this, you know, what was essentially a terrible childhood and a pretty difficult, rough, itinerant youth.
It's really interesting, though, when you think about it, because particularly the way you describe the mountains in winter, which are some of the most beautiful passages in the book, there's a sense of, you know, this place can kill me if I'm not careful. But at the same time, it's so comforting to you. It's like if you recognize where you sit on the bus, what your role is with you and nature, you're fine with it.
Yeah, I do. I think, you know, that's an interesting point, the idea that I love it and it can also kill me. And I think, you know, I'm not an adventure seeker in that way. I don't, you know, free climb or do anything like that. But I do think that there is a sense for me of accomplishment, that this is the way I live. And if I'm not careful, things can go badly pretty quickly. And, of course, there are, you know, we're bearing down on fire season, which is a big deal in the mountains, in the Rocky Mountain West. And
in Boulder Canyon had floods a few years ago, too, right?
Yeah, that's my next book. I'm writing about the floods. But I also, we live, I think, too many of us live ignoring the natural world. And I think one of the realities of the natural world is that it is wild, but it is also dangerous. And that's that thing that I was trying to get at by calling this book Rough Beauty, is that that's my sweet spot. That's the place I want to be, the place where it is a bit dangerous. But that danger affords you, it's an open vista to beauty that you can't, and joy that you can't imagine.
How long after the fire at the Bar K cabin, we haven't called it by that name yet, but that was the name of it. How long between the fire at the Bar K cabin and you getting into the other place you describe as the 2x4s with lots of holes?
That was the High Lake cabin. That's the second one. 4 months. So I lived, some friends, or they became friends, people I didn't know, offered me a cabin that they had that was even higher up the mountain, about 9,000 feet. And I lived there for 4 months. And then I found the High Lake cabin, which was also on an acre of land, near, just backed up to Forest Service land and not far from the top of Overland Mountain.
I don't want people to think this was an easy transition. I'll just drop in the phrase casually sued over the fire in here, but there was really a pile of things hitting the fan at this point in your life.
Yeah, it was a really, you know, it's one of those things, and I've actually watched this with people who have tragedy. It seems like it kind of visits them not in just one thing, but a whole host of things. I saw it with my friends in Jamestown who went through the flood. But so what happened is, yeah, the cabin burns down, and then, you know, my mentor, Lucia Berlin, died. I lost a dear student and a friend in the tsunami in Southeast Asia. And then within a week of each other, I got sued over the house that burned. And my mother had a stroke and a giant, caused by a giant brain aneurysm. And her aneurysm was about 25 millimeters big, so I'm talking huge.
Wow, that's an inch, yeah.
Yeah, so so it all kind of, and I think the first 2 years after the fire, I isolated myself so much because I was embarrassed that so many bad things were happening to me. And there was something in my makeup that said, oh my, and I think it was, you know, probably being raised Catholic, that said, oh my God, you did something to deserve this. And so it was tough. And this being sued, you know, this is what the insurance company, it's called a subrogation suit, and they sue you because they're trying to recoup, they paid the owner out, I was a renter, and they're trying to recoup their losses by suing me. And I was so kind of full of my sense of justice. I was going to, they were wrong and I was going to be right, but it takes money to be right, which was my lesson in this whole thing. I couldn't afford a lawyer. And even one lawyer I talked to said, yeah, this is not a good situation, but I would pay them because they're going to just drag this out and that's going to cost you a lot of money. So I found a lawyer eventually who worked for me for almost nothing, and it took a year, and then we went to trial, and right before trial, so we countersued, and they, right before trial, they dropped their suit, and so then to the jury, it looked like I was trying to get more money out of this insurance company for something that I had done wrong, which I didn't do wrong. So I left a fire in a wood stove, in a cabin, heated by a wood stove, that's what you do, on a day when the pipes could freeze, and I went out to my job. And the fire happened when I was gone.
Wow. So I will say this about this portion of the book too, is that we actually get to know your mother a bit more than we had in through your childhood, because she's essentially a ghost through the part of the book where you're describing your childhood with both your parents and with your father's overwhelming personality. So we get to appreciate your mother at this point in the book. But with all this stuff going on, you know, plenty of people might have considered a big change. I mean, I'm surprised you didn't say, that's it, I've had it with this, I'm moving to Chicago, someplace flat and not mountainous, you know.
You know, I think people have said that to me, and it never occurred to me to pick up and go. I'm nothing if not stubborn. And I had an idea that this is the place where I wanted to live, and that it felt like it was a good and safe space for me. I mean, I feel much safer in the mountains than I do in a city. I'll take bear in my yard any day over some unknown person in an alley. So, it never occurred to me to move. And in fact, as the crow flies, I probably moved about a mile and a half away.
So, do you ever miss the attractions of urban living, though? Being able to, you know, go to a play or a restaurant on short notice?
No, I can do those things. I mean, I live 45 minutes from Boulder now, and Boulder's got great food and, you know, good attractions. And you just go. You don't go every day, right? When you live in the mountains, you live far away. You go 3 times a week, maybe, to town. That is great for me. I get overstimulated pretty easily. Crowds are not good for me. I don't like parties. This is perfect. I like the quiet. I've been living in the mountains so long that when I moved, at the end of the book, I moved to what I euphemistically call the prairie, which is a little town outside of, prairie town outside of, in Boulder County. And street lights were a shock to me. Really, I like the way I live, and I like, and it fits my sensibility, and it gives me a really good rooted place to be.
So you're living there now because your book bio says you live in the mountains with your husband Greg.
Yes, we just eloped May 1st. We bought
congratulations.
Thank you. We bought a mountain house a year ago, and so we had lived, like I said, in this little prairie town for 3.5 years, and it was misery for me. And Greg, who's a gardener, you know, made the most amazing, beautiful garden in our yard, but it was just too much. We lived a block and a half from the train that came through in the middle of the night with its whistle and everything. And our dog, we have a new husky mix, his name is River, and he would howl to the train. So.
Oh. Adventures with huskies. That could
right,
be a whole
exactly.
book on itself, yeah. So do you still have a wood stove? I'm curious.
We do. We have a wood stove. We have actually a fire stove insert, so it's not a stove. And, you know, I was a renter living in really kind of sketchy houses. I mean, the first house actually had the house that burned down had a great wood stove. So, But there was a malfunction with the stove. A gust, a backdraft came down the stove and blew the doors open. And then in the house that I, which is the bulk of Rough Beauty, the house that I live in High Lake, the one that I stayed in for 10 years by myself, is had a wood stove, and it was a converted coal stove. And there are, I'm sure there were things in that house that weren't up to code and probably were a little dangerous. I mean, there was one electrical outlet that I never used because it always produced a huge shock.
Oh, boy.
I mean, and this is what happens when you, I mean, being a renter and also mountain living, there's all kinds of interesting, let us say, places to live.
Yeah, there's never a dull moment, really, in the book. It's called Rough Beauty, 40 Seasons of Mountain Living. Karen Ovenen writes lovingly of life in the mountains, even when it costs her things like pretty much all of her possessions. Karen, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.